This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. From the North American Review, January 4th, 1907, Chapters from My Autobiography by Mark Twain, Chapter 9, dictated December 13th, 1906. As regards the coming American monarchy, it was before the Secretary of State had been heard from that the chairman of the banquet said, "In this time of unrest, it is of great satisfaction that such a man as you, Mr. Newt, is chief advisor of the president." Mr. Newt then got up and, in the most quiet and orderly manner, touched off the successor to the San Francisco earthquake. As a result, the several state governments were well shaken up and considerably weakened. Mr. Root was prophesying. He was prophesying, and it seems to me that no shrewder and surer forecasting had been done in this country for a good many years. He did not say in so many words that we are proceeding in a steady march towards eventual and unavoidable replacement of the Republic by monarchy, but I suppose he was aware that that is the case. He notes the several steps, the customary steps, which in all the ages have led to the consolidation of loose and scattered governmental forces in the formidable centralizations of authority. But he stopped there and doesn't add up the sum. He's not unaware that heretofore the sum has been ultimate monarchy, and that the same figures can fairly be depended upon to furnish the same sum whenever and wherever they can be produced, so long as human nature shall remain as it is. But it was not needful that he do the adding, since anyone can do it. Neither would it have been gracious in him to do it. In observing the changed conditions, which in the course of time have made certain and sure the eventual seizure by the Washington government of a number of state duties and prerogatives which have been betrayed and neglected by the several states, he does not attribute those changes and the vast results which are to flow from them to any thought-out policy of any party or of any body of dreamers or schemers, but properly and rightly attributes them to that stupendous power, circumstance, which moves by laws of its own, regardless of parties and policies, and whose decrees are final and must be obeyed by all, and will be. The railway is a circumstance, the steamship is a circumstance, the telegraph is a circumstance. They were mere happenings, and to the whole world, the wise and the foolish alike, they were entirely trivial, wholly inconsequential, indeed silly, comical, grotesque. No man and no party and no thought-out policy said, "Behold, we will build railways and steamships and telegraphs, and presently you will see the condition and way of life of every man and woman and child in the nation totally changed, unimaginable." law and custom will follow, in spite of anything that anybody can do to prevent it. The changed conditions have come, and circumstance knows what is following and will follow. So does Mr. Root. His language is not unclear. It's crystal. Our whole life has swung away from the old state centers and is crystallizing about national centers. The old barriers which kept the states as separate communities are completely lost from sight. That state power of regulation and control is gradually passing into the hands of the national government, sometimes by an assertion of the interstate commerce power, sometimes by an assertion of the taxing power. The national government is taking up the performance of duties which, under the changed conditions, the separate states are no longer capable of adequately performing. We are urging forward in the development of business and social life, which tends more and more to the obliteration of state lines and the decrease of state power as compared with national power. It is useless for the advocates of state rights to inveigh against the extension of national authority in the fields of necessary control, where the states themselves fail in the performance of their duty. He is not announcing a policy. He is not forecasting what a party of planners will bring about. He is merely telling what the people will require and compel. And he could have added, which would be perfectly true, that the people will not be moved to it by speculation and cogitation, and adding, but by circumstance. That power which arbitrarily compels all their actions, and over which they have not the slightest control. The end is not yet. It is a true word. We are on the march, but at present we are only just getting started. If the states continue to fail to do their duty as required by the people, constructions of the Constitution will be found to vest the power where it will be exercised, in the national government. I do not know whether that has a sinister meaning or not, and so I will not enlarge upon it, lest I should chance to be in the wrong. It sounds like ship money come again, but it may not be so intended. Human nature being what it is, I suppose we must expect to drift into monarchy by and by. It is a saddening thought, but we cannot change our nature. We are all like the human beings, and in our blood and bone and ineradicable, we carry the seeds out of which monarchies and aristocracies are grown. Worship of gods, titles, distinctions, power. We have to worship these things and their possessors. We are all born so, and we cannot help it. We have to be despised by somebody whom we regard as above us, or we are not happy. We have to have somebody to worship and envy, or we cannot be content. In America, we manifest this in all get him, the whole nation publicly chafes and scoffs and privately envies, and also is proud of the honor which has been conferred upon us. We run over our list of titled purchases every now and then in the newspapers and discuss them and caress them and are thankful and happy. Like all the other nations, we worship money and the possessors of it. They being our aristocracy, and we have to have one. We like to read about rich people in the papers. The papers know it, and they do their best to keep this appetite liberally fed. They even leave out a football bullfight now and then to get room for all the particulars of how, according to the display heading, rich woman fell down cellar, not hurt. The falling down the cellar is of no interest to us when the woman is not rich, but no rich woman can fall down cellar, and we not yearn to know all about it and wish it was us. In a monarchy, the people willingly and rejoicingly revere and take pride in their nobilities, and are not humiliated by the reflection that this humble and hearty homage gets no return but contempt. Contempt does not shame them. They are used to it, and they recognize that it is their proper duty. We are all made like that. In Europe, we easily and quickly learn to take that attitude toward the sovereigns and the aristocracies. Moreover, it has been observed that when we get the attitude, we go on and exaggerate it, presently becoming more servile than the natives and vainer of it. The next step is to rail and scoff at republics and democracies, all of which is natural, for we have not ceased to be human beings by becoming Americans. The human race was always intended to be governed by kingship, not by popular vote. I suppose we must expect that unavoidable and irresistible circumstances will gradually take away the powers of the states and concentrate them in the central government, and that the republic will then repeat the history of all time and become a monarchy. But I believe that if we obstruct these encroachments and steadily resist them, the monarchy can be postponed for a good while yet. Dictated December 1st, 1906. An exciting event in our village, Hannibal, was the arrival of the mesmerizer. I think the year was 1850. As to that, I'm not sure, but I know the month. It was May. That detail has survived the wear of 55 years. A pair of connected little incidents of that month have served to keep the memory of it clean from me all this time. Incidents of no consequences and not worth embalming, yet my memory has preserved them carefully and flung away things of real value to give them space and make them comfortable. The truth is, a person's memory has no more sense than his conscience, and no appreciation of whatever it values in proportions. However, never mind those trifling incidents. My subject is the mesmerizer now. He advertised his show and promised marvels. village had heard of mesmerism in a general way, but had not encountered it yet. Not many people attended the first night, but the next day they had so many wonders to tell that everybody's curiosity was fired, and after that for a fortnight the magician had prosperous times. I was 14 or 15 years old, the age at which a boy is willing to endure all things, suffer all things, or to death by fire, if thereby he may be conspicuous and show off before the public. So, when I saw the subjects perform their foolish antics on the platform, make the people laugh and shout and admire, I had a burning desire to be eccentric myself. Every night, for 3 nights, I sat in a row of candidates on the platform and held the magic disc in the palm of my hand and gazed at it and tried to get sleepy, but it was a failure. I remained wide awake and had to retire defeated like the majority. Also, I had to sit there and be gnawed with envy of Hicks, our journeyman. I had to sit there and see him scamper and jump and sing, and the enchanter exclaimed, "See the snake, see the snake?" And hear him say, "My, how beautiful," in response to the suggestion that he was observing a splendid sunset. And so on, the whole insane business. I couldn't laugh, I couldn't applaud. It filled me with bitterness to have others do it, and to have people make a hero of Hicks and crowd around him when the show was over, and ask him for more and more particulars of the wonders he had seen in his visions, and manifest in many ways that they were proud to be acquainted with him. Hicks! The idea! I couldn't stand it. I was getting boiled to death in my own bile. On the fourth night, temptation came, and I was not strong enough to resist. When I had gazed at the disc a while, I pretended to be sleepy and began to nod. Straight away came the professor and made passes over my head and down my body and legs and arms, and finishing each pass with a snap of his fingers in the air to discharge the ship's electricity. Then he began to draw the disc, holding it in his fingers and telling me I could not take my eyes off it, try as I might. So I rose slowly, bent, and gazed, and followed that disc all over the place just as I had seen the others do. Then I was put through the other paces. Upon suggestion, I fled from snakes, past buckets of the fire, became excited over hot steamboat races, made love to imaginary girls and kissed them, fished from the platform and landed mud cats that outweighed me, and so on, all customary marvels, but not in the customary way. I was cautious at first and watchful, being afraid the professor would discover that I was an imposter and drive me from the platform in disgrace. remnant of my mind into the bargain. At the end of my first half hour, Hicks was a thing of the past, a fallen hero, a broken idol, and I knew it and was glad. Said in my heart, success to pride. Hicks could never have been mesmerized to the point where he could kiss an imaginary girl. Or will one either, but I was competent. Whatever Hicks had failed in, I made it a point to succeed in. Let the cost be what it might, physically or morally. He had shown several bad defects, and I had made a note of them. For instance, if the magician asked, "What do you see?" and left him to invent a vision. Himself. Hicks was dumb and blind. He couldn't see a thing nor say a word, whereas the magician soon found that when it came to seeing visions of a stunning and marketable sort, I could get along better without his help than with it. Then there was another thing. Hicks wasn't worth a tallow dip on mute mental suggestion. Whenever Simmons stood behind him and gazed at the back of his skull and tried to drive a mental suggestion into it, Hicks sat with vacant face and never suspected. If he had been noticing, he could have seen by the rapt faces of the audience that something was going on behind his back that required a response. Much as I was an imposter, I dreaded to have this test put upon me, for I knew the professor would be willing to do something, and as I couldn't know what it was, I shouldn't be exposed to the test. However, when my time came, I took my chance, and perceived by the tense and expectant faces of the people that Simmons was behind me, viewing me with all his might. I tried my best to imagine what would happen, but nothing suggested itself. I felt ashamed and miserable then. I believed that the hour of my disgrace was come, and that in another moment I should go out of that place disgraced. I ought to be ashamed to confess it, but my next thought was not how I could win the compassion of kindly hearts by going out humbly and in sorrow for my misdoings, but how I could go out most sensationally and spectacularly. There was a rusty and empty old revolver lying on the table among the properties employed in the performances. On May Day, 2 or 3 weeks before, there had been a celebration by the schools, and I had had a quarrel with the big boy who was the school bully, and I had not come out of it with credit. That boy was now seated in the middle of the house, halfway down the main aisle. I crept stealthily and impressively towards the table with a dark and murderous scowl on my face, parted from the touch of the romance, seized the revolver suddenly, flourished it, shouted the bully's name, jumped off the platform, and made a rush for him and chased him out of the house before the paralyzed people could interfere to save him. There was a storm of applause, and the magician addressing the house said, most impressively, that you may know how really remarkable this is and how wonderfully developed the subject we have in this boy. I assure you that without a single spoken word to guide him, he has carried out what I mentally whereas it was not insensible at all. I was suffering agonies. After that fourth night, that proud night, that triumphant night, subject, Simmons invited no more candidates to the platform. I performed alone every night the rest of the fortnight. In the beginning of the second week, I conquered the last doubters. Up to that time, a dozen wise old heads, the intellectual aristocracy of the town, had held out as implacable unbelievers. I was as hurt by this as if I were engaged in some honest occupation. There is nothing surprising about this. Human beings feel dishonor the most sometimes when they most deserve it. That handful of overwise old gentlemen kept on shaking their heads all the first week and saying they had seen no marvels there that could not have been produced by collusion, and they were pretty vain of their unbelief, too, and liked to show it and air it and be superior to the ignorant and gullible. Particularly old Dr. Peek, who was the ringleader of the irreconcilables, and very formidable, for he was an FFD. He was learned, white-haired, and venerable, nobly and richly clad in the fashions of an earlier and courtlier day. He was large and stately, not only seemed wise, but was what he seemed in that regard. He had great influence, and his opinion upon any matter was worth much more than that of any other person in the community. When I conquered him at last, I knew I was undisputed master of the field. Now, after more than 50 years, I acknowledge, with a few dry old tears, that I rejoiced without shame. Dictated December 2nd, 1906. In 1847, we were living in a large white house on the corner of Hill and Main Streets, a house that still stands and isn't large now, although it hasn't lost a plank. I saw it a year ago and noticed that shrinkage. My father died in it March of the year mentioned, but our family did not move out of it until some months afterward. Ours was not the only family in the house. There was another, Dr. Grant's. One day, Dr. Grant and Dr. Rayburn argued a matter on the street with sword canes, and Grant was brought home multifariously punctured. Old Dr. Peek caulked the leaks and came every day for a while to look after him. The Grants were Virginians like Peek, and one day when Grant was getting well enough to be on his feet and sit around in the parlor and talk, the conversation fell upon Virginia and old times. I was present, but the group were probably quite unconscious of me, I being only a lad and a negligible quantity. Two of the group, Dr. Peek and Mrs. Crawford, Mrs. Grant's mother, had been of the audience when the Richmond Theater burned down 36 years before, and they talked over the frightful details of that memorable tragedy. These were eyewitnesses, and with their eyes I saw it all with an intolerable sovereign jump to their death, or accumulation worse than death. The picture is before me yet, and can never fade. In due course, they talked of the colonial mansion of the Peaks, with its stately columns and its spacious ground, and by odds and ends, I picked up a clearly defined idea of the place. I was strongly interested, for I had not before heard of such palatial things from the lips of people who had seen them with their own eyes. One detail casually dropped hit my imagination hard. In the wall by the great front door, there was a round hole as big as a saucer. A British cannonball had made it in the War of the Revolution. It was breathtaking. It made history real. History had never been real to me before. Very well. 3 or 4 years later, as already mentioned, I was King Bee and sole subject in the Mesmeric Show. It was the beginning of the second week. The performance was half over, and just then the majestic Dr. Peak, with his ruffled bosom and wristbands and his gold-headed cane, entered, and the deferential citizen vacated his seat beside the Grants and made the great chief take it. This happened while I was trying to invent something fresh in the way of a vision in response to the professor's remark, "Concentrate your powers. Look, look attentively. There. Don't you see something? Concentrate. Concentrate. Now then, describe it." Without suspecting it, Dr. Peak, by entering the place, had reminded me of the talk of 3 years ago. He had also furnished me capital and was become my confederate, an accomplice in my frauds. I began on a vision, a vague and dim one, that was part of the game at the beginning of the vision. It isn't best to see it too clearly at first. It might look as if you had come loaded with it. The vision developed by degrees and gathered swing, momentum, energy. It was the Richmond fire. Dr. Peak was cold at first, and his fine face had a trace of polite scorn in it. But when he began to recognize that fire, that expression changed and his eyes began to light up. As soon as I saw that, I threw the valves wide open and turned on all the steam and gave those people a supper of fire and horrors that was calculated to last them one while. They couldn't gasp when I got through. They were petrified. Dr. Peak had risen and was standing and breathing hard. He said in a great voice, "My doubts are ended. No collusion could produce that miracle. It was totally impossible for him to know those details, yet he has described them with the clarity of an eyewitness, and with what unassailable truthfulness God knows I know. I saved the colonial mansion for the last night and solidified and perpetuated Dr. Peak's conversion with a cannonball hole. He explained in the house that I could never have heard of that small detail which differentiated this mansion from all other Virginian mansions and perfectly identified Marvel.